We're continuing our study of John. The last 2 weeks we looked at John chapter 1 and the initial interaction of Jesus with and the disciples. You most people know of the disciples being called from their boats by Jesus. That's an episode that happens after this initial interaction. We don't have time to get all those details right now. Okay, John chapter 2. So if you wanted to insert the call of the disciples from their boats, you could insert them right here between chapter 1 and chapter 2. On the third day. What third day? Third day from what? Right. So the third day, that has tipped off a lot of commentators to some speculation that John is trying to, in saying third day, emphasize some sort of theme that we might not necessarily pick up immediately without that help. So once you look at that, those words, third day, say naturally, if you're paying attention, you say the third day of what, or third day from what, or what. And then you look back and you look at chapter 1, verse 29. Chapter 1, verse 29. The next day, verse 35. The next day, verse 43. The next day, chapter 2, verse 1. The third day, right? So day, third day. So so commentators have looked at that and said, well, John is doing something with the days here in chapters 1 and 2. Remember, chapter divisions aren't there in the original text. So you're going to look for literary devices, structural literary devices to indicate where you're going to break things up and group things. And so most, I'd say probably all modern commentators see the day, next day, next day, next day, third day as having some sort of importance. There is a very small minority that say, no. John's just saying that stuff. He's not trying to say anything beyond what he says right there. But the vast majority would say there's something symbolic. There's two parties on the theme. One party, which is the dominant one, comes out of the French school of Catholic exegetes, is that this is creation imagery from Genesis chapter 1. Next day, third day. So, well, okay, what's the third day? Well, if you think back to Genesis 1, what happens on the third day? He creates the plants that bear fruit, right, with their seed in them. Go back to Genesis 1. So the third day, and all of a sudden now we've got the wine. Perfectly possible. Another way to look at this is a total of a seven-day structure, which those who point to that structure are also will say it's got double creation imagery, because you have a third day which points to the third day of creation, Genesis 1, grapes here, wine, and the fruit plants. But then if you look earlier, it looks as if there's more than 3 days. If you've got before this, you have one day, and then you have verse 29 and following is day 2, and then verse 35 and following is day 3, then day 4, verse 43 to the end of chapter 1 is day 4, which means you also now, and the third day means you've got 7-day structure, which again points, as many of the French exegetes said in the past, this is reference to the seventh day, God rested, and this is the image of in chapter 2 here of the fulfillment of the eschatological imagery of the Old Testament from Isaiah, et cetera, et cetera. But once you're onto the 7-day structure thing, then another question should arise. If this is intended as a 7-day structure, then if you go to Exodus chapter 19 through 24, you have a a reference to 7 there. There's be ready on the third day. Be ready on the third day. I will come to you on the mountain. Then they have a feast. And then he goes up on the mountain. And for 7 days, he's up on the mountain. And he receives the description of how to build the tabernacle when God would dwell among his people, which is a very important theme for the Gospel of John. Now, having said all that, it's possible that as in, there's a small minority that says, no, that's all reaching way too far out there. Especially the idea of seven. If he meant seven, he would say on the seventh day. On the seventh day. Not the third day. So which one is it? I don't know. But there you have it. There's a different speculative ideas and things like that. Someday you can write a dissertation on the topic and maybe solve the problem for us. Okay, chapter 2. On the third day, there was a marriage at Cana in Galilee. Cana in Galilee. So Galilee, we know where that is. That's the northern area of Israel where the Sea of Galilee is. Cana. Where is Cana? Well, there's a couple of different possibilities. Modern archaeologists debate about what Cana this is. What is the town? It's written in Greek here, okay? But it's not a Greek word. It's an Aramaic word or a Hebrew word in the background maybe. So what is this Cana? And so there's a couple of different possibilities, but somewhere up in Galilee. And the mother of Jesus was there. Jesus also was invited to the marriage with his disciples. So his disciples are with him. When the wine failed, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Oh, woman, what have you to do with me?" Or some translations, "What is this concern of you and me? What concern of this to me and to you? Not our business. Not our party. We're just here as guests." A couple of different ways to read that, but basically in the sense is, you know, this is not our problem. Verse 5, his mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you." Now, look what he says to her. "Oh, woman, what does this have to do with you and me? Or what concern of this is us?" Whatever it is. "My hour has not yet come." Now, that's the first occurrence of hour in the Gospel of John. And the theme of the hour of Jesus is a major theme. There's no debate about that. The hour of Jesus. It doesn't mean 60 minutes, but the hour, the moment. Something that's going to be happening in the future. What is it? As you read the whole Gospel, you see that the hour of Jesus is his crucifixion. So, what in the world could the wedding at Cana have to do with the crucifixion of Jesus? Well, if you're thinking about the crucifixion of Jesus in the other Gospels, well, I don't know. But if you look at the crucifixion of Jesus in John's Gospel, he's going to be pierced and flow with blood and water. Now, in the ancient world, you never drank wine by itself. It was always mixed with water. At a standard, you know, dinner, you would have minimum would be 50% water mix. And you'd have a majority, even in some cases, majority water, and then you know, third wine. At a serious party, you know, at a drinking party kind of thing among the Greeks, then that ratio would flip around. So you'd have 50% or even 60%, 70% wine. And then they would mix in with it water and then the spices and all sorts of other stuff. So the idea of blood and water flowing. Now, there's a lot more going on in John 19:34. I did my whole dissertation on that. So we could spend an hour just on that subject there. But setting that aside, John 19:34 for a moment and thinking of the relationship of wine and the blood of Jesus in the early Christian tradition, the Eucharistic imagery, you might speculate there'd be a connection here. Blood and water, wine, water, possible. Especially when you realize there's a Passover meal. This is during the time of the Passover, and that's going to be during the time of the Passover. In between is the Passover when he gives them the Bread of Life discourse. So a lot going on here structurally. We can't look at it all, of course. We'd be reading the whole Gospel tonight after that. But this is just to give you a little hint at how much could possibly be packed in here in chapter 2, just to what we've seen so far. My hour has not yet come. So she says, do whatever he tells you. Verse 6. Now, six stone jars were standing there for the Jewish rites of purification, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. So do whatever he tells you. A lot of commentators point out that Mary in the Gospel of John is being shown here to be one of the ideal disciples, right? She does and tells others to do whatever he tells you. The six stone jars were standing there for the Jewish rites of purification. When the Jews came to eat, they would wash. The Pharisees, the tradition of the elders at the time, was you washed your hands before you eat. Now, obviously, it's a nice idea to wash your hands before you eat. We know about microbes. They had no idea about microbes. Hook had not yet created the microscope, right? So there is no knowledge of microbes here. So cleanliness, in the sense that you and I might think of, is not on the radar screen for them. So the washing was for ritual washing, for Jewish purification, according to the Torah. The Torah says, don't touch anything unclean. What do the Pharisees do? Well, just in case they touched something unclean, they would wash their hands before they ate. It was one of the hedges around the law. And you can read about this, if you want more on this, Mark chapter 7, where we hear a description of it. So they've got stone jars there for the rites of purification. So they wash themselves before they eat, each holding 20 or 30 gallons. Jesus said to them, fill the jars with water. And they filled them to the brim. Now, if you're not reading the Gospel of John carefully, that might not hint anything to you. You might, okay, filled them to the brim. That's full. Why not? But throughout the Gospel of John, there is always this theme of the fullness. The theme of the fullness of Jesus, the fullness of the Torah, the fullness of the truth, the fullness of the light. Everything that was given before in the Old Testament was partial. When Jesus comes on the scene, it's always in the fullness. So this, many commentators will point out to it, says, fill them to the brim. Is part of that whole Jonine theme that Jesus has come and everything is maxed out. And they filled them, and he, verse 8, said to them, now draw some out and take it to the steward of the feast. Now, who's the steward of the feast? This is the guy who's in charge of mixing wine. All right, so at any big, you know, at a party, especially at a wedding party, the bride and the groom are not going to be messing with the food and the wine. You got to have somebody in charge of that stuff. So they would hire somebody, or it'd be a family member, who would be in charge of the wine. A lot of times at a party, they'll ask somebody to be, oversee the food, or ask somebody to oversee the little bar, you know, over in the bartender or something, kind of stand in. So this is the stand-in bartender. His job is not just to serve, you know, take some caps off some bottles of beer, but his job is to make sure the wine is being served properly and that it's being mixed properly. So this is a guy who's real keen on wine. The guy who got this job is the guy who really knew his stuff. All right, so they drew it. He said, draw some out and take it to the steward of the feast, the guy who's in charge of the wine. So they took it, and when the steward of the feast tasted the water, now become wine. Okay, now, if you're a Baptist, that last part of that verse is something you tend to glaze right over. I've heard sometimes people, some very simple exegesis on the internet, they weren't drinking wine, they were drinking water, but because it was, Jesus made it taste like wine, or it was water that had taken on the flavor of wine, or it was water that, you can go on and on, right? If you're a Baptist, you can see why they're doing this. So that's not what it says. It says, and there's two problems with the Baptist interpretation here. It says, it had become wine, okay? It hadn't become something that seemed to be like wine. It had become wine. And he did not know where it had come from. though the servants who had drawn the water knew. So he didn't know where he's coming from. This is, John throws that in there because this is important information. He's not just a guy who's kind of just casually overseeing the party. This guy, this is his job. The food and stuff taken care of other people by other people. He might be overseeing, you know, the, at a distance what might be happening with food, but the ladies would have taken care of that. This is his job to make sure that the right wine is served at the right time and the right mix. Okay. And all of a sudden, they break, the wine's failing. He's getting nervous, wringing his hands. What are we going to do? Now, these parties went on for a whole week. Now, this isn't just one night. They just kind of ran out of wine. Hopefully, people go home now. This was a one-week party. And that might be the reason why you have the third day there. It might have something to do with the seven-day structure of the wedding party. Anyway, all right. So on the third day, there's this wedding at Cana. There's a party. Jesus is there. They've run out of wine. And Jesus makes more for them. And the guy who's in charge of the party, who everyone's going to look at when they run out of wine, everyone's going to look at if something goes wrong with the wine. They now bring him a cup of wine to taste it and to say what to do with it. As he's wringing his hands, wondering what we're going to do, the wine's starting to get short. The people are still drinking. And we've still got a couple more days of the party to go on here. And all of a sudden, a servant walks up with a glass of a cup of something. He drinks it. And when he tasted the water that had now become wine, and when he tasted the water that had now become wine, and did not know where it come from, though the servants who had drawn the water knew, the steward of the feast called the bridegroom. Stop everything. Right? There's something strange here. Call the bridegroom. Bridegroom comes over. Yes. What's going on? And he says, every man serves the good wine first. Right? You're making me look like an idiot here, right? You just brought out wine that is, I've never tasted anything like this. So he's messed his job up, right? He's thinking he's blown the whole thing, right? Because you're supposed to serve the good wine first. He says, every man serves the good wine first, and when they have drunk freely, now the Greek says when they're drunk, okay? Once they're drunk, you then serve the bad wine, okay? Then the poor wine. But you kept the good wine until now. You made me look like an idiot. So, what's going on here? Obviously, I mean, you know, wine has varying qualities and things. Now, Palestine, modern day Israel, whatever you want to call it, the Holy Land, was the Napa Valley of the Middle East. It is the perfect climate for growing grapes and olives. It's very hot. It's very dry, except up in the right near the Sea of Galilee. It's a little humid there. But everywhere else, it's very hot, very dry. This is perfect climate for growing grapes and olives in. It's also hilly. Both of those love rocky, hilly soil, well-drained. So they had so much wine and olives that were such high quality in that region, in the Holy Land, that was their export. Other regions couldn't produce it like this. So they would, their export, they'd import other stuff, but they would export wine and oil, wine and oil. So this is a place that is, this is the Napa Valley of grapes, of wine. And this is a guy who knows his wine. And he had obviously beforehand checked out what wine was available before the party started. He's got it figured out. He's got his different barrels. And he's, all right, we're going to start with this one. Then we're going to work to this one. This one, all of a sudden, the wine's getting lower and lower. Oh, my goodness, what do we do? And all of a sudden, there's some new wine to show up. Where'd this come from? And it's beyond imagination. This is good wine. The other stuff is the bad wine, the poor wine compared to this. Again, the Baptists have a problem with this, although they never read it in the Greek here. It says, when they are drunk, you can't, this is not Welsh scriptures. Then the poor wine, after that. But you've kept the good wine until now. This, the first of his signs, Jesus did at Cana in Galilee and manifested his glory. And his disciples believed in him. So a lot there. Notice the next line here before we, so just structurally, big picture stuff. Look at verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand. So this is the first of the three Passovers of John's gospel. If you ask the average Christian, how long was Jesus' earthly ministry? Most Christians who know something about their faith will say, oh, it's 3 years. Why do they say that? Because it's kind of common knowledge. There's about a three-year ministry. Well, why? How do we know that? Well, it's from John's gospel. John tells us about three Passovers. This one mentioned here in verse 13. Another one mentioned in chapter 6. And the last one, of course, at the Passion, Death, and Resurrection of Jesus. So there are three Passovers mentioned in John's gospel. So it's from that we figure, well, it's got to be somewhere around a three-year ministry. There's obviously time before and time after the first and last Passover. And so then you ask the question, well, are these Passovers connected? And it seems like they are. You have a multiplication of wine at the first Passover, which is a sign, and his disciples believe in him. Fast forward to the next Passover, chapter 6. He multiplies bread, which is a sign, and the people, because of the sign, want to make him king. And then you go into the rest of chapter 6, you get the bread of life discourse, and it's all about, do you believe or not believe? Do you believe or not believe? It's all about belief. Okay, so then when you come to the last Passover, of course, Jesus gives them, in the Last Supper, in the mystical supper, bread and wine, which he says is his body and blood. But what's shocking, if you've read the Gospels, you know that John doesn't tell you about the Last Supper. All you hear about the Last Supper is they've gathered in an upper room, and Jesus talks to them and washes their feet. Then they take off. He says, after they had a meal, wash their feet and take off. And people have often wondered, why doesn't John give us the Eucharistic imagery that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do at the Last Supper? Because he's already done it. He's already done it the first two Passovers, which he's assuming you see in the connection. The synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, do not tell you about these first two Passovers and the multiplication of wine, the multiplication of bread at Passovers. They tell you about the multiplication of bread. They don't tell you it's at a Passover. They don't tell you anything about the multiplication of wine. Instead, they teach you Eucharistic theology simply at the last Passover. John, however, rewinds a bit to show the things Jesus did to prepare them for this. And you might say, well, how could he expect those who read his gospel to then connect the dots? Because John's gospel was not intended to be put in a drawer of a Best Western or a Hilton and hope people have a come to Jesus moment, okay? The gospel of John was written for a community of baptized, chrismated, Eucharist receiving Christians in the 90s. They've been doing this every time they've gathered since Jesus ascended. Okay? There's no confusion for them of what you do as a Christian when you get together. You get together, you break the presider, the guy who's in charge there, breaks the bread, and then gives them wine and tells them this is the body and blood of Jesus. So this is the normal thing they do. They know that Jesus had done this at the Last Supper. This is, if there's any text that a Christian knows by the time you get to the 90s, it's the story of the Last Supper. And well, if you look at the Gospel of John, you'll see that he does this all over the place. Things that the Synoptic Gospels don't emphasize, John emphasizes. Why does he do that? He's got his own particular Jonah theology that's different from the Synoptic theology. No, there's no reason to repeat the information. So what the Synoptics have been telling, they're all the same, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They're almost identical. So, and these are the stories that Christians have been saying and telling and understanding about the life of Jesus and what he did from the you know, somewhere around 30 AD until we get to the 80s or 90s, decades later. And so when John sets out to write down his gospel, when he teaches things, he teaches things that the other gospel writers didn't talk about. Because these are stories, in fact, what text of the gospel was being read and understood and in Ephesus, where John probably wrote this? Luke. In fact, if you look at Luke's gospel and John's gospel, there's where you get all the connections between the two. It's only in Luke and John that you got a Lazarus, a Martha, and a Mary. And we could go on. Luke and John tell us about Annas and Caiaphas, the two high priests. There's tons of parallels between Luke and John. Why? Because Luke was in Ephesus. Luke's gospel was in Ephesus because it was a Pauline church originally. John's there at the end and is teaching them things that Matthew, Mark, and Luke didn't talk about, because John sees an emphasis and sees an importance on some other things that are helpful at that time in the 90s. Okay, so the Passover. Then also look at the verse now, verse 11. This, the first of his signs, the first of his signs. So there's a lot loaded in there. It's not only one of his signs, it's one of the first of his signs. Now, when you hear signs, what do you think of? Signs. It's in John's gospel that Jesus' miracles are called signs. The Synoptics say miracles. John says signs. Why are you saying signs? Because if you know the prologue, Jesus is the new Moses. Moses worked signs to bring about belief by the people and Pharaoh, right? What was Moses' first sign? Turning water into blood. Even it says in the stone jars, right? So you can see right off the bat here, as we saw in the prologue, Jesus is the new Moses. But notice the switch. He didn't turn water into blood, he turned water into wine. Moses turned water into blood. Again, if you look at what's going on here, right? Okay, then the first of his signs. So we're going to see a number of signs Jesus is going to work now throughout this first half of the gospel, leading all the way up to about, chapter 18. Chapter 18 is where most commentators see a movement into what they call the Book of Glory. This is primarily the work of Raymond Brown. Raymond Brown suggested that the Gospel of John was divided into two halves, the Book of Signs and the Book of Glory. While it's helpful to see that in the sense that you certainly do get a lot of emphasis on Jesus' signs, and then all of a sudden they kind of come to an end, and then you talk about the glory at the end of the Gospel. You can see every other word is the word glory. It doesn't begin and end with a scene like that, like one book and another book. And so I would imagine, again, it's a relatively recent idea there, but I would imagine what seems a little bit more organic in the text would be to divide it into three sections, according to the three Passovers, which everyone agrees are obviously somehow thematically connected. But whatever the case may be, the first of his signs. So this is the beginning of his signs. Jesus is going to work a number of signs through the Gospel of John. And every sign is intended to bring about belief. Just like the story of Moses. You can think of Exodus chapter 4, verse 1, etc. Okay. And what happened? He manifested his glory. This is where Raymond Brown would point out, okay, see, there's a connection. You got the signs and then the glory. It's true, but there's probably some more going on there. By the way, Raymond Brown, I don't know what you guys have heard or know of him, His early stuff was really good. His commentary on the Gospel of John back in the 60s, excellent. Late Brown, he died in 95 or something. Late Brown is just garbage. He wrote a book called Death of the Messiah and A Birth of the Messiah, which was much earlier, which was already had some problems. And then Death of the Messiah. By the time you get to Death of the Messiah, and then his introduction to the New Testament, his introduction to the Gospel of John, some of those posthumous stuff, it just, the whole thing had fallen apart. But early Brown, his early commentaries from the 60s on the Gospel of John are excellent. Very well done. Okay, so, and he manifested his glory. Now, manifested his glory. Who has glory? Glory. You got to go back to the prologue, right? God became flesh and dwelt among us, right? He manifested his glory. This is the glory cloud in the meeting tent, right? Jesus is God in the new meeting tent. He is the temple of God on earth. He's in an earthly tent. And at various times throughout the Gospel of John, he's going to manifest his glory. We're going to realize who he is, the God incarnate. And his disciples believed in him. Now, when you hear that, his disciples believed in him, you say, that's really good. When you read the rest of the Gospel of John, you're going to see that's okay, but it's not ideal. What we would have wanted to see here was chapter 2, verse 1. On the third day, there was a marriage at Cana in Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. And Jesus, who was invited to the marriage, with his disciples who believed in him, also came along. That's what you'd want to see. Once you've read the Gospel of John about 20 times, you're going to see that's where it should have been. But the problem is that the disciples who are with him believed in him because of this sign. And that's not ideal belief in the Gospel of John. The ideal belief in the Gospel of John is to believe because of the word of Jesus, which he's been doing up to this point, teaching them. But they haven't yet believed. They've got a sense who he might be. At this point, they come to believe. But it's based upon a sign. And sign belief, sign faith, for lack of a better term, is inadequate. It's not evil. It's not wrong. But it's inadequate. It's partial faith. Ideal faith in the Gospel of John is to believe because of the word. Think of the end of the Gospel. Thomas, you believe because you have seen. Blessed are those who believe and have not seen. We have had time to go through the whole Gospel. Let's point this out to you. Before we end here tonight, I'll show you at the end of the chapter. We're going to see this again. Okay. So the glory, that's that revel, think of the of chapter 1, and the word became flesh, dwelt among us, the tabernacle and glory of God, to remind you of Exodus 25, verse 8, I will build my tabernacle and dwell among my people. It should remind you of Exodus chapter 40, verse 35, the glory cloud, the Shekinah glory cloud, filled the tabernacle. Verse 12, after this he went down to Capernaum, with his mother and his brethren. Went down? What? You have to go north. Remember, up and down is, we're not talking about a map here. We're talking about topography. Cana is up in the hills. Capernaum is down on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. With his mother and his brethren and his disciples, and there they stayed for a few days. Now, Jesus is going to spend a lot of time in that city. This is where Peter's house is. If you have never been there, start saving your pennies. We're hoping we might be able to go this coming summer. And if that's the case, if it happens just right, it'll be half the price of what it's been in the past, which is half the price of any tour you're going to get from America in the Holy Land. It's about $2,000. Typical is about right around $4,000. And the whole thing is first class from beginning to end. And you see way more stuff than you'd ever see on a typical American tour. But anyway, one of the places we always go is to Capernaum. And there, the thing to see there, among many other great things, are the synagogue where Jesus preached the Bread of Life discourse in the synagogue, Capernaum, as you hear in chapter 6. It's still there. The foundation and some of the walls. And the Peter's house, which is, you can throw a rock and hit it. It's just across the street. And then on the other side of Peter's house is the beach, because he was a fisherman, so he had a beach, he had a beachfront property. But Capernaum, he goes there. If you read the synoptics, we'll hear about how much time Peter spends in Peter's house. You know, he heals Peter's mother-in-law, and he just stays there with Peter's family. Peter was married, he had kids, we know about him. And so he stays there, and that's his kind of his staging ground for his mission in that northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Jesus will go on trips, but he always comes back to that town. In fact, in the synoptics, it'll be called his town. He went back to his home, to his town. I mean, that town, not Nazareth. So this is John's little reference to it. And I point that out to you because the synoptics will tell about Jesus spending almost all of his time on the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee. John's gospel, however, will tell us a lot more going on. He'll tell us about that there were three Passovers. There's a three-year ministry of Jesus. It wasn't just, you know, 1 year or something. But when you read the synoptics, you could just guess it might have been about a year long or something. Who knows? You don't know how long it is. So from John, we hear about the three Passovers. And then from John, we hear about Jesus constantly going back to Jerusalem and Judea and then going back to Galilee. Then to Samaria, passing through Samaria, go to Galilee. And he goes back to Judea and he goes back to Galilee. So it's John's gospel tells us about Jesus moving a little bit larger area than simply the northern shore of the Sea of Galilee, though that seemed to be the main place he hung out. By the way, this is also one of the connections of John and Luke. Luke's the one that tells us about Jesus' time as a child, 12 years old, getting lost in Jerusalem. We hear about Jesus being in Jerusalem also in Luke's gospel, though much less than John. Verse 13, the Passover of the Jews was at hand. So I'd highlight that. It's very important. The Passover was at hand. Jesus went up to Jerusalem in the temple. He found those who were selling oxen, the sheep, and pigeons, and the money changers at their business. And making a whip of cords, he drove them all out, the sheep and oxen, out of the temple. And he poured out the coins, the money changers, and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, take these things away. You shall not make my father's house a house of trade. His disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for thy house will consume me. The Jews then said to him, what sign, there's your sign, right? What sign do you do? What sign do you have you to show us for doing this, right? By what authority? You have come and mess this whole place up. Can you imagine what kind of a mess it would have been? So Jesus says to them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days, I will raise it up. Now, where was he? He wasn't inside the temple building itself. There were no money changers and pigeons in there. This is the, if you remember, around the temple building, which was not very big, and the temple building had two rooms, the inner room, the outer room, right, was a yard with a wall. In Moses' time, it was a yard with a goat skin tent or a fence around it. And this created three realms of holiness, right? Set apartedness. There was you go into the yard, into the temple precinct area. Now you're in one stage of holiness. Then you step further into the outer room of the temple, the entry room area, and that's the second realm of holiness. And then the high priest only goes once a year into the Holy of Holies, right? Holy, 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 thrice holy, and he goes into the inner one. All right, so where did this happen? The money changers and all this stuff was going on in that yard around the building, the temple precinct, the courtyard, basically, kind of thing. Well, why does Jesus do this? What's wrong with having pigeons? They're selling pigeons and sheep and stuff for sacrifice. And the money changers, the people were coming with coins with Caesar on them. Well, you can't use that for a donation to the temple. So they'd switch it out for a temple coin. You know, I'm sure there, you know, the exchange rates and stuff might have been some cheating going on, but Jesus doesn't address that. He says, you turn this house into a house of trade, because it's supposed to be a house of prayer. A house of prayer. And we hear about this also in the Synoptics when Jesus does this. He tells them, you turn my house, it's supposed to be a house of prayer, a house of thieves, a den of thieves. So this place is supposed to be the place where the Gentiles come pray. When Solomon built the temple, you can read about this back in 1 Kings chapter 6 to 8 is the building project. Chapters 9 and 10 is the dedication, 8, 9, and 10. The dedication, 8 and 9, sorry, 8 and 9, is the dedication of the temple. And Solomon prays in chapter 8 that the Lord would make this a house of prayer, not only for Israel, but that even the Gentiles would come and pray toward this place, and God would hear their prayer. This is in 1 Kings chapter 8. All right, so, but the place where the Gentiles could come, that is into that courtyard area, but they could go no further, had been turned into a place where you couldn't pray. And this is really, in many ways, a commentary on, I mean, it's a historical event, but the fact that this was going on is really a image of the bigger problem, that Israel was not converting the nations. They had no interest in converting the nations. If someone wanted to become a convert, okay, fine, we'll circumcise, you keep kosher. But they weren't out evangelizing. They had turned inward. And in fact, among the Jews, they had turned inward among themselves, right? There were certain groups, as opposed to looking outward to convert the nations. That was their role. They're supposed to be a priestly nation to convert the nations. So they turned the one thing that could be a place where the Gentiles could come and hear the psalms being chanted, smell the incense, and get a sense of the glory of the God of Israel, they had turned it in, what was supposed to be a doorway, they turned into a wall, in a sense, so it would stop them from conversion. Imagine coming all the way from some far off land because you had some special prayer request, someone was sick in your family or you were sick, and you came all the way, this is before 747s, and you make all your way there, and then you get to this place, and you're being bumped in noise of sheep and pigeons and people knocking into you as you're trying to pray. Jesus says, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. That's the sign for you. Now, when we hear that, we might think just like those standing there. What, are you crazy? How could you raise up a temple in 3 days? He says, the Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple. Well, it's been longer than that, right? This is the temple of Ezra and Nehemiah, or the temple of Zerubbabel, whatever you want to call it. This is the post-exilic temple that was built after they returned from Babylon. But it's so new in all the changes they've done to it since Herod the Great started working on it, now Herod's son, that it's almost considered to be a new temple. So a lot of times historians will talk about the pre-exilic temple, the post-exilic temple, and Herod's temple, which was the post-exilic temple, but he had changed so much, thrown so much money at it, rebuilt so many different things, that it was almost like a third temple, Herod's temple, that he had built. Why was he doing this? Well, it wasn't because it was piety. Herod was an Edomite and an Ishmaelite. He had no right to be king over the people of Israel. The book of Deuteronomy chapter 17, the Torah even says you cannot have a foreigner over you. And furthermore, the promise to David, 2 Samuel 7, was that only his line would reign over the people in Jerusalem. But here you've got someone who's not only not a line of David, he's not even an Israelite. So he tries to do everything he can to make himself look legit, because the promise to David and his line in 2 Samuel 7 would they would be the ones who would build the temple. And so he's trying to do that. I'm the long-awaited Messiah. I'm the line of David, sort of. Okay. Now, obviously, misunderstand Jesus. He spoke of the temple of his body. When, therefore, he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. Okay, so It's only after the fact that, oh, wow, now he figured out what he was talking about. I was wondering about that, Peter. I know, John. Why didn't you ask him? I don't know. So it's only after Jesus has been raised from the dead, looking back and they realize so many things he's done, hindsight, so many things he said that suddenly made sense. He's been talking about his death and resurrection from the beginning. So this is important for us. Not only does it look forward to the death and resurrection of Jesus, but again, this is part of the theme of the Gospel of John, which runs throughout the whole Gospel. Jesus is the temple of God. Jesus is the place where the glory cloud of God dwells. Jesus is the fulfillment of the tent made by Moses. Jesus is the temple fulfilled the temple that was made by Solomon. Jesus is the place where the glory of God dwells on earth and dwells among his people. He is, Exodus chapter 25, verse 8, the dwelling place where God may dwell among his people. Okay. What else there? Okay. Verse 23. Now, when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, notice again, Passover, Passover, Passover. This wasn't just an offhanded remark about the Passover. This is the time of the Passover. Now he's in Jerusalem. He was up in Galilee. Now he's in Jerusalem. Many believed in his name. Wow, good news, huh? Look at this. When they saw the signs which he did, when they're believing not because of what Jesus has said, they're believing his words because they're backed up with signs. And then they believe, okay, this guy maybe he's legit. And look what it says here. If you didn't understand that's a problem, the next part would make sense. But Jesus did not trust himself to them because he knew all men and needed no one to bear witness of men, for he himself knew what was in man. So if you read through the gospel, you're going to see this is a constant problem. People will not believe Jesus' words. They'll only believe, and sometimes temporarily, because he works a sign. There's very few who will believe only his word. Right now you say, well, that's understandable. Okay. Well, this is part of that Moses theme. If you go back to Exodus chapter 4, now, just hold your hand here and flip back to Exodus. What's this? Exodus chapter 4. So God says to Moses at Mount Sinai, hey, I got a job for you. Go to Egypt, get my people out of there, and bring them to this mountain. I got some information for them. All right? That's chapter 3 in a nutshell. When God's done talking to Moses, before Moses leaves Mount Sinai to go to Egypt, before the Exodus, Moses answered, this is chapter 4, verse 1, but behold, they will not believe me or listen to my voice. For they will say the Lord did not appear to you. Right? Moses presents the problem right at the bat. This people's a stiff-necked people. They're not going to listen to what I say. And therefore, they won't believe that I was sent by you. This is a type, an image of what's going to happen with Jesus. And then God says, the Lord said, what is that in your hand? He said, a rod. And he said, cast it to the ground. So he cast it to the ground, became a serpent. Moses fled from. But the Lord said to Moses, put out your hand and take it by the tail. So he put out his hand and caught it, and it became a rod in his hand. They may believe that the Lord, the God of the fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, has sent you. Again, the Lord said, put your hand into your bosom. And he put his hand in the bosom. And when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, as white as snow. Then God said, put your hand back into it. So he put his hand back in the bosom, and then it became like child's flesh. Verse 8, if they will not believe you, God said, or believe the first sign, notice the sign here, if they will not believe even these two signs, or the voice, you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it out on the dry ground, and the water become blood. So these are signs. Moses is going to work signs. They're signs. They're plagues upon Egypt, but they're signs. They're signs. Signs pointing to proof that God sent Moses, and that what he said was true. All right, now with that in mind, and again, if you read through the book of Exodus, you're going to see this a theme throughout the whole. Are you going to believe the one whom God has sent? Are you going to believe his words? Or are you going to believe just because of the signs he works? So once you know the book of Exodus well, and then you jump to the Gospel of John, you can see what's going on here, especially if you've read the prologue, the comparisons of Moses and Jesus, Moses and Jesus in the prologue. So Jesus is shown here to be the new Moses, the one who has arisen, a prophet like me shall arise, right? This is Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 15. Moses says, don't worry, the Lord will send a prophet like me who shall arise, and he will lead you into the place where God wants you to go. Well, who was that? That was Joshua, right? He led him to the promised land. But remember, Joshua and Jesus is the same name, and John's hoping you're going to get that connection there. So you can see he's the new Moses who's going to bring them, or the new Joshua now, the prophet like Moses, who's going to lead them into the promised land. Salvation. The theme of the signs, as you read through the gospel, again, you're going to see that over and over again, the importance in the belief in the word. Think of Martha and Mary, right? They believe Jesus. When he comes in to deal with the death of Lazarus, they believe him. Do you believe? She says, I believe. We believe. They believe his words. Then he raises Lazarus, and then the Jews believe over there. So there's two different groups there. There's Mary and Martha who believe before the raising of Lazarus. The Jews of Judea from Jerusalem, they're there, they see the thing, and then they believe. What's the problem? What happens when Jesus stops working signs? Are you going to still believe his word? What happens if you don't see signs? Are you going to believe his word? And this is an important thing for the Gospel of John, because we're going to get to the 90s, decades later, when there's going to be all sorts of Christians who never saw Jesus. They've never even heard Jesus speak. They have never seen him work a sign. They were not witnesses to his resurrection. Why do they believe then in the 90s? How were there Christians gathered around John the Apostle who had seen and heard these things? How were there Christians in the 90s? Turn over to John chapter 17, we'll end there, and see why this is so important for the gospel. John chapter 17. Jesus says, as he's praying for his disciples, just before the passion begins. John chapter 17, verse 20. John chapter 17, verse 20. He's been praying for his disciples that the Father would guard them and protect them. And he says in verse 20, I do not pray for these only, my disciples, my 12, but also for those who believe in me through their word. And there, Jesus is praying for you and for me. Right? There he is praying not only for the disciples of John in the 90s, the church in Ephesus, he's praying for all Christians who were not eyewitnesses to the resurrection or the signs which Jesus worked, but believe in him through the words of the apostles, which we are reading right now. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and the Holy Spirit, both now and ever, and unto ages of ages. Amen.